And good afternoon, Scott Spears along with you here on this Wednesday, June the 12th, 2019, 17 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program, and we have got a great program in store for you today. Coming up at 12:30, we're going to be joined by Jim Robinault, author of The Harding Affair, attorney, to discuss John Dean's testimony. John Dean, remember him? Former White House counsel to Richard Nixon, who used to live right here in Marion, Ohio. John Dean gave testimony on Monday about the Mueller report and President Donald Trump. So we are going to talk with his friend, Jim Robinault, an author, about that particular testimony, 12:30 to 1 p.m. today. And then 1:10 to 2 p.m., we hope to be joined by legendary television judge, Judge Joe Brown, to discuss maybe a few things of that nature, political, and also maybe just other things going on in the world. So a lot going on here at WWGH Radio, but phone lines are open right now. If you'd like to call in, 740-383-9944. We've got about 12 minutes. Before we're going to go over to Jim Robinault, do want to let you know, though, our big announcement today. Legendary star of the hit TV series Hee Haw, Lulu Roman, is coming to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM in Marion, Ohio, on Friday, June the 28th, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the debut of the TV series Hee Haw, which debuted in 1969. On CBS, Lulu is the last person still living who was on the first episode in 1969 and the last episode in 1992. She'll be live in studio on Friday, June the 28th, 10 to 11 a.m. She'll be doing an interview with me on her life and times. 11:10 to 12 p.m., she'll be on with myself and Weasel Boy. 12:10 to 1 p.m., she'll be on The Exchange Club with Charlie Evers, Brandy Downs, Weasel Boy, and myself. 1 to 3 p.m., she'll be with Charlie Evers on The Charlie Evers Show. And 3:10 to 4 p.m., we'll be having a live radio variety show with Lulu Roman right here in studio. Now, after all that happens, Lulu will then head over to Perkins Restaurant here in Marion, located at 1197 Mount Vernon Avenue, and she'll be doing a book signing of her newest book, This Is My Story, This Is My Song, Lulu Roman, The Autobiography. Now, if you come to Perkins 5 to 9 on June the 28th and buy one of Lulu's books, you'll get 10% off your meal. Now, you cannot come in and just meet her. You got to be eating, or you've got to be buying a book, or you got to be doing both. But you just can't come into the restaurant to meet her, because it is a restaurant and they're selling food there. But come in, get dinner, and meet Lulu. That'd be a great event, and buy the book. Lulu will also be appearing on The Weasel Show on Saturday, June the 29th from 10:10 till 11 a.m. Right at the end of his program, an extra hour will happen that morning with Lulu Roman. All this can be heard right here on 107.1 FM or live on the internet at WWGH1071.com or on any mobile device by downloading the free TuneIn app and searching WWGH. This event is supported by the Quality Inn, address 227 James Way, right here in Marion. So that's the big event. Lulu Roman from Hee Haw comes to Marion and WWGH Radio Friday, June the 28th, 10:10 a.m. until 3 p.m. Are you excited for this event? Give me a call. We've got about 9 minutes before Jim Robinault. Does anybody have anything to say out there? 740-383-9944. We've got about 9 minutes of open conversation here. 740-383-9944. Certainly would enjoy hearing from you on this particular topic. It's going to be just a tremendous amount of fun. Hee Haw ran for 25 years. Very few shows have a span like that. 25 years on the air. Started on CBS and ended up in syndication. And I had the privilege and honor to get to interview Roy Clark in person when he was at the Palace Theater. I believe that was back maybe 2010, 2011. But I'll never forget, it was a very cold and snowy December day, and I was told to go down to the Palace Theater and meet Roy Clark, do an interview with him. And I thought he would be rehearsing on stage, so I pull in the Palace parking lot. This is before, I believe, before the May Pavilion was built. And I see his big tour bus out there. So I go knock on the door of the palace, and I can't get any answer there, so I don't think anybody was in the palace. It was the afternoon of the show, maybe 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I see some people over on the bus, and I go knock on the bus door, and I tell them who I am and what I'm there to do. And of course, they let me come right on the bus, and I had my recording machine there. And there's Roy Clark, and could not have been nicer. We sat right there on his tour bus and did the interview. It was about a 25, maybe 30-minute interview. He was very gracious with his time. He was a genuinely nice guy. He was a genuinely funny guy. And we took a picture when the interview was over. He was very gracious with that. I think one of his people actually took the picture because I didn't have anybody with me, so somebody else took the picture. Now, that was the days before everybody carried an Android phone, so this was an old disposable camera that sometimes I would carry around. So I did the interview with Roy Clark, and before I'm getting ready to exit the bus, he says, "Are you coming to the show tonight?" And I said, I had not got any tickets. I had not planned on it. And he said, "Well, tonight you come back here as my guest." And I thought, wow, that's very, very nice. So he said, just come to the back door over here before the show starts, and tell him you're my guest, and I'll get you some seats. I thought, well, that's great. So that night, that afternoon, I went home and talked to the person who I was going to go with that night, and we made plans to come back. So we show up back at the Palace Theater. I think the show started at 7. We showed back up about probably 6:15, 6:30, because there was a meet and greet going on backstage. So I go to that same stage back door, and I knock on the door. And I tell the person who answers the door, which is a palace employee or palace volunteer, that Scott Spears and Roy Clark has two tickets laid back for me tonight. Now, I can see the meet and greet going on right in front of me. Roy is dressed up for the show, and he's taking pictures with the people who've bought tickets for the meet and greet and so on and so forth. So I said this to the person who was supposed to go get the tickets. Well, the person was a palace employee, and I don't think she liked that Roy had made this promise. So she walks over and gets the palace manager. Now, it's not the palace manager that it is now. This is years back. And the palace manager comes over and says, basically, I don't remember the words that were used, but basically it was, there are no tickets for you, or you're not supposed to be back here, or something of that nature. That was kind of the point. And Roy, who was standing about 15 feet from where I was standing with my date that night, said, "Oh," he must have saw me, and he must have saw what was going on over there with the palace manager. And he says, "Oh, Scott, come on in," which, as I'm coming in now, I see the palace manager's face, and it is not a happy face, let's say. So I walk over, and Roy says, yes, your seats are right out there, and they took us right out there and gave us seats, and it was a tremendous show, and that's the kind of guy Roy Clark was. And those are the things I'll remember about him, and Lulu, who is a wonderful person. I've had the chance to talk to her many times. I look forward to meeting her in just a few, 17 days until this big event on June the 28th, when she'll be live in studio from 10 in the morning till 3 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio. It doesn't get any better than that. Another funny thing about Roy Clark in that particular trip when he was here. Up on the marquee out front, every year the palace had been bringing somebody in to do a Christmas show. I remember one year, who are some of the people who did the Christmas shows at the palace? But they always tried to bring a kind of a famous person in to do the Christmas show. Like Anne Murray, I think, did the Christmas show one year. So this was supposed to be the Roy Clark Christmas show. And up on the marquee on the front of the palace, it said Roy Clark Christmas Show, because it was Christmas. So I didn't know Roy Clark even did Christmas music. So when I was sitting on the bus with him interviewing him, after the interview was over, I turned off the microphone and I said, boy, I'll be excited to come back here tonight to see this Christmas show. I said, what Christmas songs do you do? And he said, I don't do a Christmas show. So I really don't know how that got all fouled up. But I remember in all the literature that went out, it was the Roy Clark Christmas show. And on the marquee at the palace, it was the Roy Clark Christmas show. But if you went to the show that night, and a lot of people did, the palace seats 1,400 people, and it was pretty near full that night. I think, matter of fact, I think it was full. You did not see a Christmas show. Roy Clark, at that time, he was touring. He had, of course, a full band he was touring with. But he was also touring with some young up-and-coming singer, and I wish I could remember the name. But I do remember there was a reality show at that time called Nashville Star, I believe. Now, I don't know if this was one of the winners of Nashville Star, but it was one of the people who had competed on Nashville Star. And they were touring around with Roy Clark, and it was just a lot of fun. And one thing I also remember about Roy Clark is he looked just the same in person, and some people don't, as he looked on television. You know, he was just that type of guy. I do remember him telling me that he had done something, because Roy Clark was so synonymous with the banjo for all his years on Hee Haw. He had told me he had done something to his hand. I don't know if it was tore a muscle or tore some tendons, or I don't know exactly what had happened. But he said he did not play the banjo very much anymore, and I'm not sure if he played the banjo that night at the show. I don't think he did, because he had hurt his hand by playing the banjo so much. See, I've never played a guitar or a banjo. I don't know what toll that takes on your hand or why a banjo would take more of a toll on your hand than something else would. But those are my reminiscences of Roy Clark. And also want to let you know, Lulu Roman will be on this show tomorrow from 12:15 to 1 o'clock talking about her upcoming appearance in Marion on June the 28th. So stay tuned for that. Lulu Roman tomorrow on this show from 12:15 until 1 o'clock. And also do want to remind you that the Adam the Computer Guy show will be... it's Wednesday. That's tomorrow. The Adam the Computer Guy show will be on tomorrow, Thursday, from 2:10 to 3 p.m. Today, offbeat news and trivia with Nate Redman. A lot of great giveaways coming up live today, 4:10 to 5 p.m. on this station. Offbeat news and trivia with Nate Redman today. And he has got a tremendous amount of giveaways today, 4:10 to 5 p.m. live here on WWGH Radio. So you're not going to want to miss that for love nor money. Now, as we continue along with the program today, as many of you know, Richard Nixon's former White House counsel, John Dean, gave testimony on Monday about the Mueller report and President Donald Trump. And it was very interesting and compelling testimony, to be sure. Now, joining us today, we're very honored to be joined, as we always are, by attorney and author Jim Robinault, who is also a good friend of John Dean. And a matter of fact, a few years ago, Jim and John appeared in Marion together. Jim is the author of some great books, The Harding Affair, which we all remember, which he debuted here in Marion a few years ago, back in 2009. And another book that Jim has published, Watergate, Roe v. Wade, Vietnam, and the Month That Changed America Forever. That was published in 2015. What a great book that is. And speaking of Richard Nixon and John Dean and President Trump and the Mueller report, what a great pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones, as it always is, Jim Robinault. Jim, how are you?
Good, Scott. How are you?
Oh, it's good to speak with you. I'm doing well. Jim, Monday, well, let's start here. The Mueller report, when it came out, what'd you think?
Well, what I thought was that it was so dense and so difficult to comprehend unless you were a lawyer that it wasn't going to be widely read. And that thought has come true. I mean, I think very few people have read the report from stem to stern.
Now, the report itself, two things were addressed in the report: Russian collusion and obstruction of justice. Now, as an attorney, what did you take from the report?
Well, it's interesting. You know, John Dean and I started our continuing legal education program in 2011 that we called the Watergate CLE. And the very first program was all about obstruction of justice and the use or misuse of presidential powers in obstructing an investigation. So we've been teaching this for almost a decade, and we started the course years before Donald Trump was even thought of as a candidate for president. So none of this is kind of after the fact looking at it. And what we found back then and what I find today is that the Mueller report accurately describes very serious obstruction crimes, and also finds that the president or the candidate, either way you want to look at them, did not know necessarily of the underlying crime when it happened. And therefore, the cover-up, as they say, from Watergate is worse than the crime. In other words, Richard Nixon didn't know about the Watergate break-in before it happened. He did, though, obstruct the investigation into it. The Mueller report finds that there doesn't appear to be evidence that the Trump camp was conspiring with the Russians, as that is defined as a federal crime. But there's no question that Trump has endeavored in many instances to obstruct that investigation. So it's very similar in that respect. And the Mueller report, therefore, kind of is the current day version of what happened in Watergate.
It's very interesting because, as you pointed out, you have done lectures and tours with John Dean. Now, the Mueller report came out a couple months ago. From that time until John's testimony on Monday, had you spoken to him about the Mueller report? And if so, what did he have to say?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it a lot. And he actually asked me to come to Washington this weekend, and I did. And I worked on his statement that he gave that is out there. You can find the full statement. And we worked together on that and then worked on his preparing him for his testimony. Then I went over to the House Judiciary Committee with him on Monday. And if you look at you'll see pictures of me sitting behind him in the committee room. So we talked a lot about it. And his statement is a really good summary of what both of us agree about the obstruction part of the Mueller report.
As you both were putting this together last weekend, going over it, what was important to convey, the most important point to convey on Monday?
I think the most important point was that the obstruction activity by Trump was pretty serious and really echoed multiple things that happened during Watergate. So, for example, the first is the firing of Comey by Trump and what followed. That clearly echoed the Saturday Night Massacre and the firing of Archibald Cox by President Nixon. Both were attempts to stop an investigation into wrongdoing by the president. So that's one thing. A second thing is that in both instances, the president got directly involved in trying to limit the investigation outside of this just firing the lead investigator to limit it. And in Trump's case, it was with Michael Flynn telling Comey to go easy on him and, you know, to let this thing pass. It was exactly the same thing Nixon did when he first learned that his committee to reelect was involved in the break-in. He sent the CIA over to the FBI to tell him to shut down the investigation. So in both ways, direct interference with an FBI investigation. And then the thing that I think, there are two things that I think trouble at least legal scholars the most about obstructive activity here. One is with Nixon's White House counsel, a guy named Don McGahn, who was ordered to fire Robert Mueller. And then a year later, when news of that leaked, Trump again met with him and told McGahn to fabricate evidence to say that he never ordered him to fire Mueller. In both instances, McGahn refused because he had been ordered, and he refused to make up, you know, and fabricate evidence. That's very serious obstructive behavior that is indictable. If he had not been a sitting president, I think that that activity alone is something that would have gotten him indicted. And then the last thing that echoes Watergate is where it's a so-called dangling of pardons. In other words, the president has a very unique power, and that is the power of pardon and clemency. Well, it can be used for good and it can be used for bad. It's a pretty unrestricted power, but if you're going to use it to get people to not cooperate with investigators and say, you know, just hang tight, be tough, don't cooperate if you don't, and if, even if you're convicted, you know, I'm the president, I can undo that with my pardon power. Well, that is precisely what happened in Watergate with Howard Hunt. He had Chuck Colson as an emissary go on his behalf to Nixon. It's on tape. Nixon says Hunt's case is different, you know, and essentially the message went back, don't worry about it, go ahead and plead guilty, and you will not spend 40 years in prison. The president will take care of you. The actual code words used were Christmas comes once a year, meaning by the first Christmas that he's in prison, he'll be out. So that appears to have been going on with respect to Trump and Manafort. If you read the report, all the things that they pulled together, I think very clearly Robert Mueller thought that the dangling of the pardons with Manafort, to a certain extent with Flynn, I think Roger Stone is involved in that, although I think his name is redacted. But you can pretty well tell from what's around the redactions that they're talking about Roger Stone. So, I mean, those things are very serious problems. And in Nixon's case, the promising or dangling of pardons was mentioned by or identified by the House as Article 1 of its in Article 1 of its impeachment.
That's very interesting because we all know now that Michael Flynn cooperated to a certain extent with Robert Mueller, but Roger Stone and Paul Manafort did not. Do you think they'll be pardoned?
I think, well, it's hard to tell. Every time I think I know what's going to happen with Trump, he gets even more outrageous. So, I mean, it sure seems like it'd be too hot for him to do that. But on the other hand, he just may. I think it's very hard to tell. And it also depends on how serious the impeachment inquiry becomes. I really doubt it would happen before the elections. It could happen after the elections if he wins. But my guess is that it's not going to be a serious issue until after the election.
You were in the room on Monday, Jim. What was the atmosphere, just in general, like in the room?
Well, you know what, Scott? It was vile. And the guy who led the pack in being vile was Jim Jordan.
Our congressman.
Yeah. So Jim Jordan, and also my hometown, Lima, I think he represents, too. That district stretches from, I think, Oberlin to Lima. But he, let me tell you this, and I'm writing about this for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, too. Before John testified and before the other MSNBC contributors, Bart McQuaid and Joyce Vance testified, they were all taken into a room by the Democrats. And the Democrats brought in the House parliamentarian, a woman who was very stern looking. And they came in and said, look, there is a rule of decorum that you can't, as a witness, attack the president personally. So when you talk about the Mueller report, if you're going to don't draw conclusions that the president committed a crime, that's not for you to do. Talk in hypotheticals. If somebody did this, then it would be obstruction of justice. And that poor woman then sat through the entire hearing. And I noticed she kept jumping up and down as people were crossing lines on all that. So John Dean was carefully instructed by the Democrats not to disparage the president. And Jim Jordan, go back and watch the clip. He deliberately baited Dean almost for 5 minutes of, so tell me what it is you don't like about Donald Trump. Tell me what it is that you don't like about Donald Trump. Tell me what it is. I mean, it was just absolutely improper. It was way out of bounds. And finally, watch the clip. Dean says, I can't answer your question because of the rules of decorum. Now, the audience actually took that as a joke, but it wasn't a joke. It was Dean following the rules that he'd been given by the Democrats. And so it was just vile. I mean, you know, that I saw two parties play by different sets of the rules. The Democrats were trying to follow the rules, and the Republicans were just flouting them. They didn't care. And Jim Jordan was right out front being the guy asking those questions. You go back and look at that clip, you'll see it, that he's trying to bait him to do something that will then get an objection and potentially get him sanctioned for not following the rules. It really was disgusting.
When you talked to John Dean when it was over, what did he feel about that most popular exchange of the day, probably the most popular clip with Jim Jordan?
Well, he doesn't have much respect for him. And so, but you know what? He's been attacked by better people. He's lived with this his whole life. They've been coming after him since Watergate. The good news for him is that everything that happened in Watergate is on tape. The good news is that, you know, in 2014, he wrote and published the definitive book on all the tapes. So he knows it better than he did back when he lived through it. And all these bogus and baloney things like John ordered the break-in, I mean, they're absolutely disproven by a taped and taping system that, you know, you don't have better evidence in any proceeding than, you know, an actual recording. So, you know, he's lived with this for a long time. The good news is that his story is entirely consistent with what happened from day one. He was on the wrong side of the law. He saw he was in trouble. He stood up and he said, we got to stop it. He was the only one who did. He was the youngest guy in the room. He eventually broke with the president. He was attacked for a year. And when the tapes came out, they corroborated everything he said 100%. So history will treat him well as being someone who was a bad guy who then, you know, fessed up, came forward, took his medicine, and stopped ongoing crime. So, I, you know, he's been attacked by better people than Jim Jordan, so I don't think it really bothered him much.
It's very interesting because when we look back at Watergate and some of the testimony, we certainly remember John Dean's. We certainly remember Alexander Butterfield, who is the one who let the world know that conversations were taped inside the Oval Office with Richard Nixon. We know now what part Woodward and Bernstein with Deep Throat were, what was going on there. And we also know that the tapes did come out. We did hear some
right.
tapes. What is that, in this situation with President Trump, what are the parallels between that? Are there any parallels?
There's no taping system. So that obviously is something that is difficult. But on the other hand, you've got some people, and this is the fight that's going on right now. You've got some people like Don McGahn, who did appear to do the right thing, and to interdict, you know, what Trump was trying to do, like when he asked him to fire Mueller. And at some point, he's going to be able to testify. And when people hear him directly testify about these events, they're going to find him credible. They're going to find him compelling. And it's going to be direct evidence that it's not backed up by tapes, but as I understand it from reading the report, it's backed up by contemporaneous memos and notes. You remember the famous, why do you keep notes, Trump says to him. So it's going to be backed up by that, and it's going to be backed up by statements that McGahn made to his assistants in the White House counsel's office, just like Comey's testimony is backed up by contemporaneous memos and things he said to people at the time. So I think there's going to be a pretty strong record of what exactly happened, and while it's not tapes, it's going to be a strong record.
Obviously, we all remember that what eventually led to Richard Nixon's resignation was there was an impeachment, or there was going to be, and he was told by his own colleagues, Barry Goldwater, one of them, a fellow Republican, that he did not have the votes, so Nixon decided to leave office. Is there any chance that the Republicans in the Senate, even if there is an impeachment in the House by the Democrats, are ever going to vote to remove this president or convict him of anything?
No, 0%. The people right now in the Senate have no backbone and could care less at this point. And I think truly the Trumpian statement, if you could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and nobody would convict him, is true. I think that Senate would say, well, that guy probably deserved a good killing. They don't care. And they're interested in keeping him in power and continuing this Trump revolution. So it's not going to happen in terms of the Senate. Now, I think what is likely to happen is that at some point there's going to be so much pressure that there will be an impeachment proceeding brought. But we will, you know, I think that the Democrats, to me, if they're smart, they'll drag it out like the Republicans did Benghazi and, you know, let it bleed into the election without even calling it for a vote. And the election should decide the issue. I'm not in favor of impeachment. I think that's a dangerous thing for the country. And then the election should decide it. And if Donald Trump gets reelected, then they might have to seriously figure out what they're going to do about bringing it to a vote and taking it to a Senate. But right now, there's no way in the world the Senate would pass anything at this point.
With the election about a year and a half away, if President Trump were not to win re-election and he were to leave office in January of 2021, is he really facing legal jeopardy in the Southern District of New York, and possibly because of these issues if he was out of office?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a very, very high likelihood he's going to be indicted if he leaves office in 2021. I haven't studied the statute of limitations, so I'm not opining on that, but I think he absolutely is going to be indicted for lots of different things, financial improprieties and this obstruction behavior.
What does Donald Trump have going for him that Richard Nixon did not have going for him?
Richard Nixon faced an entirely Democratic Senate and Congress. So the opposite party was the majority. And that's one of the reasons. And by the way, it wasn't just that it was Democrats. Ultimately, you had to have some strong Republicans who had backbone and who had morals, people like Howard Baker in the Senate. Those people had to stand up, and they did. And so, you know, Nixon was put to the test because he lied to everybody about what he was doing. He lied to these Republicans. And once the tapes came out, you know, that credibility was so shot that he was done. Donald Trump, on the other hand, has shown himself to be someone who lies with impunity. And people just shake their heads. They don't take it as seriously. And he clearly has, you know, a mixed Congress. You know, the Democrats run the House and the Republicans run the Senate. So I think he knows that he's pretty immune from being impeached. And I think he wants to play it. He would love it if there was an impeachment proceeding brought. I mean, he wants to play the martyr and wants to play, you know, that the Democrats are overstating their hand and et cetera. And he's extremely effective at doing that sort of thing.
On Monday, the president, of course, remarked, John Dean's been a loser for many years. When John heard about that, what was his reaction?
He didn't care. I mean, he doesn't try to pay attention to stuff like that because he's had, you know, 45 years of this sort of thing. And it really is, he's got thick skin, it rolls off his back, whatever metaphor you want to use. And he not only thinks very little of Trump, you know, who I think it's pretty demonstrable. The guy has never read books and doesn't really know history, sort of thing. But I think John, he has described it to me and he described it in his testimony that ever since Trump was elected, he's got a pit in his stomach that this is dangerous and this presidency is dangerous. He's writing a book right now about Trump on authoritarians and what happens when they take over a government, and he's very concerned about it, as are a lot of people.
We all remember that President Nixon had an enemies list, and I guess there's some thought that maybe President Trump has one of these as well, because John said Monday, I believe on CNN, that he was proud to be on Trump's enemies list.
Right.
Is that a real thing, as it was with Nixon, where he was having people go through tax returns and things like that, or is it just an I don't like you type of thing?
No, he doesn't have a list. Nixon literally had a list. And by the way, John Dean was part of the group that helped compile that list, too. So, I mean, he truly was a guy who was on the bad side of the moon for a while and finally came out into the light and, you know, fessed up and et cetera. But Trump does not have a list. What Trump has is this proclivity for turning on anybody who turns on him. I mean, he turns on him with a vengeance. He's, as he says, a great counterpuncher. Look at what he did with Michael Cohen. You know, great guy, wonderful guy. The minute he finally tells the truth about what happened with Stormy Daniels, he's a rat. He's a liar. His family's involved in crime. You know, in the same with anybody else who turns on him, he turns on them with a vengeance. And that's just part of the way he plays the game. It's a very vindictive style of personality.
For people who might not remember Watergate and might not remember John Dean's part in that, why was this testimony on Monday significant?
You know, I wish it would have been more significant, frankly. His testimony was preempted by a helicopter crash in New York, so that instead of this being widely seen on the cable news, those companies, I think, wrongly switched to that helicopter crash, which turned out to be nothing, and they kind of knew it early on. And so very few people saw what he said. And that's too bad. I mean, I think people can read about it, but it's being spun, as you can imagine, like crazy on all sides. And the Republicans are very good at spinning stuff. So, you know, I think it would have been more effective had that quirk not happened in terms of getting the message out. But I think ultimately he was just there because the Trump is refusing to let his people testify, which I think is improper. And they wanted to get people out there to start talking about the report with human faces because nobody's going to read it. And so I think that's kind of where they're going. But this thing is never going to get off the ground until Don McGahn sits in the seat and begins to testify, which I believe will happen. And Jerry Nadler said that to me directly on Monday, that they believe they're going to get McGahn and that it won't be all that long before they do.
Now, obviously, McGahn has refused to do this. I think the president has asked him not to do this. How can they get him there?
Well, they took a step yesterday. They subpoena. Okay, so you start with that. You're a lawyer. You've got executive and attorney-client privileges. You have to assert those on behalf of your client when you're subpoenaed, which McGahn has done. But at some point, you're allowed to testify after you get through all those objections and everything else if you are compelled through contempt to come testify. And here's the way it works with McGahn. McGahn went to the prosecutors with Trump's blessing, testified for over 30 hours in front of them. That's why he's cited about 500 times in the report. Then that report was made public by President Trump. So they have waived the attorney-client privilege and executive privilege with respect to everything that's in that report. They may still have an argument that stuff that's not in that report, McGahn can say, I refuse to answer based on executive privilege or attorney-client privilege. But frankly, the main stuff that we're concerned about is in the report. It's out in the open. The privileges have been waived. And there's no reason in the world he should not have to come and testify about that. And I think eventually, if he doesn't, a court will find that he is compelled to do so.
Is he the most important person to hear from?
By far. You know, everybody's been talking about Robert Mueller. Robert Mueller's like calling Sam Ervin, you know, or calling Sam Dash, or, you know, the investigators are calling Archibald Cox. You know, those guys are the investigators. They, as Mueller says, he found what he found. He put out what he put out. I don't think there's much else, frankly, for him to really talk about. You got to get to the witnesses who are the real fact witnesses. And McGahn is the biggest one. Hope Hicks, by the way, is a close second. And I think she wants to testify, too. So, and there with her, you have no privileges. But anyway, those two are definitely big ones.
It's very interesting, Mueller. The report has been released, and he gave his 8-minute statement a few weeks ago.
Right.
What do you think he was saying? Because everybody interprets it a different way. What do you think he was saying through the report and through that 8-minute statement?
Well, again, if you're a lawyer and you've been teaching obstruction of justice for almost a decade, you know exactly what he was doing. If you read his report, he clearly says there is substantial evidence of intent to obstruct on behalf of the president. What he's saying is, I would have indicted this guy if he wasn't president. But he also said there is precedent that says I can't do that while he's sitting as a president, and that the only people who can deal with this issue are Congress. So this was clearly a handoff, very similar to what was called the roadmap back in Watergate when Sirica's grand jury insisted that their information be given to Congress because it was really for Congress to decide what to do with it. So it is 100% clear that that's what Mueller intended, and I think he's probably quite surprised that Congress hasn't moved yet. I think he was also alarmed that Barr said, oh, there's nothing in here in obstruction, which is why he has come out and essentially said, that's not what I said. I didn't say there's not obstruction. I can't reach that issue because of precedent of not indicting the sitting president. So now Congress has to pick this up.
Jim, final question here, and I think it's an important question, and I'm throwing you a long ball here for somebody who's read the report. And obviously, throw in what John Dean would feel about this, too. What we think we know about the 2016 election, the last presidential election, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, is that Russia did interfere, but there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians that would have been a crime. Now, all that being said, did Hillary Clinton really lose that election? Would she have lost that election without the help of Russia, according to the Mueller report?
Well, first of all, the Mueller report does not use the word collusion. It is not a defined legal term. Collusion, to me, has been shown by all the contacts. What it says is there's no evidence of a conspiracy, which requires an agreement between two parties to do something. So one party can be acting in a certain way with the encouragement of the other, but if there's no agreement, there's no conspiracy. So I think there was collusion. I think that is not said in the Mueller report that there's not collusion. He doesn't use that term. But do I think Hillary lost this or would have lost it without it? I think that the release of the hacked emails had a material impact on the election. So, yeah, I think that activity by the Russians and WikiLeaks had a material impact on our election, and I think that is the main reason that she lost. She was a poor candidate for a lot of reasons, but I still think she would have won had those emails not been released as they were at strategic times.
Mm. It's a fascinating report. It was a fascinating day, and it continues to be a fascinating story. Jim Robinault, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure, Jim.
Okay, Scott. Talk to you later.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, we're going to take a break and come back right after this.
It is an amazing night here, and it's great time. And tonight, does that give them momentum?
Yes, I do. I